This week, U.S. stocks posted the biggest rally in years, with the Dow Jones Industrials adding 425 points. Welcome, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzik, back with you here for another big GoldSeek.com radio show with top interviews from leading industry professionals, as well as the economic headlines affecting your investing portfolios. Well, Gerald Celente is one of my top guests this week, head of the Trends Research Institute and author of the Trends Journal. Gerald Celente thinks gold has limited downside risk, but big upside potential. Investors are gearing up for the next precious metals bull market. Once the yellow metal blasts through 1400, he expects a new gold rush will bring plenty of investment momentum back into the market. Then Peter Granditz joins me with his take on the markets. He says China could be hoarding gold, stockpiling much more than officially reported in anticipation of a free floating yuan within the next few years. Recent dollar strength is an illusion. It's really just weakness from competing currencies. Russia's central bank just added the largest amount of gold in 15 years, and a 20% portfolio investment in gold and silver is an insurance plan that can not only throw off interest, but has no monthly premium. A win-win situation. And then Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the market weather report. Mostly cloudy skies appeared over the markets this week on dollar strength and a big equities rally. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, the yellow metal was off just $7, though, about 0.5%, finishing at $12.31 an ounce, a solid close. Silver dropped only 8 cents, finishing at $17.19 an ounce. The XAU Gold and Silver Equities Index dropped about 1.5%, down over a point to $75.93, while palladium bucked the trend, adding $26, finishing near $7.81 an ounce. Platinum was off 11, down 1%, finishing at $12.51 an ounce, while West Texas Intermediate crude was off $1.50, about 2% for the week, finishing at $81.30 per barrel. Well, interest in the precious metals is solid amid renewed Ebola concerns in the U.S. This week, a physician tested positive in the city that never sleeps, New York. A U.S. doctor tested positive for Ebola after returning from the hard-hit Ebola area in Guinea, where he worked as a global aid provider. This was the first case of the virus in New York City with millions of inhabitants. The infected physician reportedly rode the subway system, could have unintentionally exposed thousands to the virus. Currently, there's no known cure, but some researchers agree that boosting vitamin C intake is an essential element to fending off and recovering from the disease, since many of the symptoms are highly scurvy-like. Remember, the human body is one of only three mammals that does not produce its own vitamin C. So sugar-free sources are highly recommended. This, of course, is why guinea pigs are often used in trials and tests, because they're one of the three mammals that also don't produce vitamin C. And also, colloidal silver could be another low-risk, low-cost tool at the front lines. But, of course, keep in mind, there's not a lot of actual hard empirical data. It's just theoretical at this point. On to a more positive note, the world's second biggest gold-consuming nation, India, increased purchases by 20% amid their Diwali festival season. It sent gold premiums soaring by $17 per ounce over London prices. That's about a $5 jump in a week. Diwali is a key Indian festival for millions worldwide each fall season, and it represents the largest gold purchasing season for the nation. The festival also celebrates Lakshmi of wealth and prosperity and investment. Demand is expected to remain robust into the wedding season that extends well into next year, and the total silver investment over the next decade could rise by 1 billion ounces. This according to the Silver Institute's new report produced by CPM Group. Moving on, next week the FOMC is slated to meet on the 28th and the 29th. The Federal Open Market Committee will likely announce the end of the infamous QE bond buying stimulus. Although this could be a bullish event for the greenback, it will be interesting to see if it results with a buy the rumor, sell the fact scenario, given that the U.S. dollar has rallied virtually without ceasing for over 3 consecutive months. Precious metals, bottom line. Well, could the Fed meeting next week lead to a capitulation moment for the precious metals? I think it's one intriguing possibility. For the time being, though, caution is advisable, and I expect a retest of the recent lows. Turning to the Wall Street Report, visibility virtually unlimited over the New York Stock Exchange. The Dow added 425 points, up over 2.5%, closing at, well, within earshot of 17,000 on much better than expected economic numbers. The S&P 500 picked up over 4%, finishing near 2,000, while the NASDAQ closed at 4,483, up 225 points. That's almost 5.5%. I mean, these guys are shooting for that year 2000 high peak zenith, aren't they? Around 5,000. The top story driving the markets this week, well, investors regained their risk appetites on better-than-expected domestic economic numbers on Thursday. Positive corporate earnings results reassured equities investors that the economy is still on track. In addition, the Labor Department reported that first-time claims for U.S. jobless benefits rose, but held below the key 300,000 level, and that's an important threshold, while the four-week average dropped to the lowest point in nearly 15 years. Add to the mix positive reports from China and the Eurozone, and it looks like maybe the global economic economy is firing on all eight cylinders. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, what a difference 7 days can make. Investors remain still highly fearful. Our seven-component index is, the pendulum is still extended far into the fearful category. So really, you wouldn't expect to see something like this amid one of the strongest rallies in months, let alone years. This suggests from a contrarian perspective that for the time being, the bulls will remain in charge. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with listeners' question and answers, as well as Peter Grandich and Gerald Celente. So we'd like for you to stay with us right here at GoldSeek. Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
All right, we're glad to have you back with us here at GoldSeek.com Radio, opening up the phone lines for listeners' questions.
Hi, Chris. John moved from Downers Grove, Illinois, to San Diego. I got a comment on what's going on with the ECB and the Fed, and I'd like your take on this, see if this viewpoint is valid. I got a hunch they're playing tag team here. The Fed, knowing they've gone way too far, has got to at least give the impression that they're going to cut back on bond purchases and raise interest rates. And I think the ECB coordinating with them and purchase 1 trillion euros worth of junk. There's one fly in the ointment for these guys, it seems. Germany. Germany's starting to get a little riled about the loose monetary policies at the ECB. But to tell you the truth, I'm laying my bet on the bankers. The bankers are going to control whatever happens. It doesn't make any difference how many politicians and judges in Germany rail against this loose monetary policy. In the end, the bankers are going to win. And even if everything blows up in their face, they'll be brought in as the saviors again. They're going to save the day. So anyway, the brief synopsis, they're playing tag team. They're tag teaming us. The Fed is pretending to cut or really will cut, pretending they're going to raise interest rates. In the meantime, ECB is picking up water pail and going to slosh even more liquidity into the system. So what's your take on this? Great show. Keep up the good work.
First up, it's John from San Diego. He says that capital is fleeing the European Union into the U.S. stock market and the real estate market. Well, hi, John. You know, you probably know that I first suggested about a year ago that capital flight from the European Union was boosting the U.S. markets, beginning, or I should really say accelerating, with the Ukraine crisis. But, you know, the situation has cooled down for the time being, which has slowed the money flow. Plus, the ECB has upped the ante, I think, in this Fed's version of Texas No Limits poker. I mean, the ECB ministers dropped their benchmark lending rate to the lowest level in history of any central bank into negative territory. So let's think about this. Scratching your heads, how can you have a negative interest rate? Well, investors actually pay money to the borrower. Let's break it down. My hard-earned cash, I don't want any interest. Instead, I'll pay you to have it. Well, this economic sleight of hand punishes savers around the world, those who need it the most and who worked hard for most of their lives so that they could have a comfortable retirement, and as well as conservative investors. Instead, it encourages highly speculative endeavors, and I really have no problem with speculare, the original word from Italy, but I have no problem whatsoever with speculation in moderation. But the problem comes from over leverage like big CDS plays, mortgage-backed securities, even some penny stocks. There's simply few opportunities to earn a decent yield. And I think what you're really driving at here is what's really going on behind the scenes. And, you know, simply the banks are holding on to trillions of dollars and euros and yen on their balance sheet. They're investing it, the rest of it, into the stock market, bond market, real estate funds, but it's not going to us. That's right. The working class, the middle class. And guess whose money it is? You guessed it. They're just not giving it back to society because the very people to whom they owe their wealth and existence are deemed untrustworthy with their own funds. But as soon as the financial institutions collude and decide the top is in place of these markets, then I think they'll start to pull the funds from them en masse, searching for a safe haven. Guess where as much as $20 trillion could be headed. Title of this radio show, Gold, Gold Seek. So that's a quick answer to the question. I liken it to a game of hot potato, but unfortunately replace the potato with a live hand grenade.
Hi, Chris. It's Rome out of Oregon. Long time no talk. So pleased to go with you and yours. I had a question about the future as you see it. I know the dollar is weak and at some point it's got to crash, but don't you think that the Fed would like to choose the time that it crashes for the power to be? And when it does crash, don't you think that they'll have something in place, some option after some degree of pain by everybody, and people, for lack of a better word, will take a new currency, you know, instead of the old one? So anyway, just curious to hear about the future health. I really appreciate your show. Thank you for all that you do. And hope you're taking care. Bye.
Next up, longtime listener Rome from Oregon. Hi, Rome. Wow, I'm a little more concerned about your phone service than the currency. Kidding aside, if I heard you correctly, you really want to know what the Fed's most likely contingency plan is for the U.S. dollar and just what our officials plan to do when the greenback goes the way that 100% of all fiat currencies have gone before. Even Voltaire pointed it out. You guessed it, zero. We've speculated for years on this show that the powers that be are preparing for an Amero, or the North American currency, a currency that spans Canada, U.S., and Mexico, which could replace or trade side by side with the dollar, similar to the border towns in the U.S. and Mexico with the peso-dollar arrangement. So Americans could wake up one morning, turn on their laptop computers, their iPhones, check their savings and checking account balances at Wells Fargo, and see the same $20,000 account balance, but instead of USD next to the bottom line, AMO. That's right, Ameros. And it'll still be 20,000 AMOs, but they might have half the purchasing power or less than the day or week or month before. Instant wealth confiscation compliments we the sheeple, 300 million American citizens, but it gets even more fun. The Social Security and pension funds will also be denominated in Ameros. So the true loss, theoretically, could be much greater from an economic standpoint. Interestingly, gold, silver, and many tangible investments would instantaneously skyrocket by at least 50% and perhaps much higher as investors scramble to shield their remaining cash or physical dollars on hand, turning to precious metals, maybe even bitcoins, to protect against further shenanigans. But of course, most of this can be avoided by simply following the advice of the top investment money managers for over a century. Simply hold 15 to 20% of your funds in physical precious metals. Thank you, Rome. And thanks for sticking with us here for years. Next up, it's John again from San Diego.
Chris, John from San Diego, formerly Downers Grove, Illinois. Just wanted to add one thing to my earlier commentary about the Fed and the ECB playing us a tag team game. Obviously, money is fleeing from Europe right now. Everybody's afraid over there that they're going to devalue the euros. That money is apparently moving into the U.S. stock market and probably the real estate market and the bond market. This could well be the reason why we witnessed that violent rally on Friday of what was the Dow up 200 some points. How long that's going to keep up is anybody's guess, but if I were a guessing man or a betting man, I'll bet you that this is given the stock market rally a new lease on life. I was expecting a crash this fall, but if this keeps up in Europe, unless somebody puts the brakes on plans on depreciating the euro by a trillion euros over the next however long, this rally could keep on pummeling away, even though it should crash. As far as I'm concerned, I hope it does crash. I hope the Dow goes down to 2,500. That will make me a very wealthy man. I threw two more cents into the mix. Illuminate the situation for us about what's really going on here. Okay, thank you. Great show. Bye-bye.
He's concerned by the dollar rally, and he says it's all smoke and mirrors and that the euro and the yen are declining relative to the dollar. Well, hi, John. You know, I think it's a solid observation on your part. It ties in with my earlier comments. And of course, global funds must flood into the dollar when the euro pays negative interest. I mean, it's similar to holding up a sign and saying, please don't take my euros. Hold dollars instead, right? Plus, you know, Abenomics continues to depreciate the yen. And in the attempt to hold up the economy that's facing severe demographic issues, just like we are here in the U.S., that according to Harry S. Dent Jr., a regular on this show. All right, closing down the phone lines and reaching into the digital mailbag. I hope I don't get shocked. Alan says he just listened to the interview with David Gurwitz. He found it very interesting, and he thinks that this generation has lost its financial common sense, that our parents are now retired and risk averse and not participating. The new generation just doesn't have the experience and painful memory of historical events and past patterns. There's some naivete on our part. And he has gained this information as an airline pilot trainer, where he says they study catastrophic mistakes of the past in great detail using simulators, noting that losing money doesn't quite have the same life or death consequences which motivate the risk that they face. Well, you know, Alan, I think your profession has served you well as an investor. In fact, this is precisely the topic of my PhD thesis. Complete, it's just being, you know, take about 12 months to hone and hopefully accept. And then, of course, I have to defend it. One of the outcomes of my proposed thesis is that we need a national warning service for the public regarding financial markets. And we have a national weather radar service, right? Well, the problem is that folks are convinced they are right. And that when we buy this illusion of the efficient market hypothesis, you essentially accept the fact, well, there is nothing but randomness. Folks have been lured into complacency as a society. It's a great peril to all of us. You know, just-in-time groceries, necessities, medicine, fast food, even payment systems are a huge risk to virtually everyone who find themselves living, well, from paycheck to paycheck. As a society, we need to return to a more basic mindset, but you know, with, I think, a technological slant. You know, I think the image of an Amish family with the horse and buggy, you know, comes to mind, but maybe with a satellite dish on top or a laptop on the beach. Maybe the modern Amish family in an RV. Maybe that's what we all need to have. Do we need to have a bug-out Winnebago with a satellite dish and solar panels? I mean, I've got the dish and the solar panels. All I need is the Winnebago. Anybody want to trade me for some satellite dish setup? I mean, we've got to embrace, I think, the old-fashioned work ethic and the We're going to need basic living standards, self-reliance. We're going to need a community spirit. I just don't think Big Brother is going to be able to help us. Maybe a dollar collapse in months or years. I mean, survival skills, you know, they always come in handy. I think we also have to add to the mixed threat of global warfare. And it's just, you know, getting almost too harrowing to contemplate. On a more positive note, you know, most of our listeners have been stockpiling canned and freeze-dried foods for some time, as well as eliminating debt, waste, and accumulating precious metals. So I think we have a fellowship of like-minded preppers. Stay in touch with me, and maybe I can direct you to some folks in your area. Next up, it's Vidya. And he says that the media source that he watches claims that silver is becoming even more scarce than before, and it's difficult to find new mining claims. So then why is the gold-to-silver ratio so close to 70 instead of the naturally occurring rate of 17.5, according to the Geological Survey? A topic that's near and dear to me and most of the guests on my show. Deposits occur much differently in this metal, AG, than AU. Silver pulls near the surface, whereas gold runs deep in veins, and it makes mining much more challenging for gold, which leaves a considerable amount of that ore, the yellow metal, in the ground. So from this vantage point, you are correct. However, you know, silver is dispersed, I think, much more widely, and is found chiefly now around copper, nickel deposits, as well as other precious metals, such as palladium, platinum, and other rare earths. So silver, through these peripheral operations, I find abundant. You are right in that this presents some interesting scenarios. Firstly, in the event of a global war or energy shortage or embargoes, etc., you know, such activities would likely be curtailed, making silver, I think, considerably more rare than gold. And of course, now remember, there's also the industrial supplies, which can be depleted quickly with insufficient silver ore reserves available and the lack of replenishment from current stockpiles. I mean, that I think is a solid argument for owning gold and silver bullion. Silver is a strategic metal as well, required in every area of military and governmental, not to mention industrial applications. So if your goal is monetary, you know, you want to focus on gold. That's your go-to asset. If your goal is strategic, silver is the investment. Together, though, you have your bases covered. We want to thank you, everyone, today for all your questions and comments. Don't forget you can call into us toll-free, 1-800-507-6531. We'd like for you to jot this down. Please put it on a Post-it pad, program it into your iPhone or to your regular telephone, 1-800-507-6531. You can record and delete as many times as you like. Get it just right. And if you'd prefer to remain anonymous, we don't mind. 1-800-507-6531. More GoldSeek.com radio. Stay with us at GoldSeek. Is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Gerald Celente, director of the Trends Research Institute, his team has the Trends Journal, and they've got another big, hard-hitting, in-depth report out. Welcome back, Gerald Celente.
Well, thanks for having me.
Want to see the end to the madness. Cover story. I don't know about you. I want to see the end of the madness. How are we going to see the end of global warfare? You know, I thought that the First World War, the war to end all wars, Huh. I don't think that moniker stuck, did it? The next go-round, we ended up with a nuclear age, right? But it didn't end warfare. It was supposed to end all of war ad infinitum. It didn't work. Tell us how we're going to see the end of this madness, or are we?
Well, we're going to do our part to make it happen. And on May 2nd, 2015, from the most historic crossroads in the United States, the only crossroads where on each corner there's a pre-Revolutionary War stone building where the seeds of democracy were sown, we're launching OccupyPeace.us. This is only for the United States. And it's based upon the principles from colonial Kingston, New York, that the founding fathers set forth in founding this country. And that is no foreign entanglements. And people say, well, you know, it was a different world back then. No, it wasn't. The world was at war back then, too. And when you listen to Madison, Jefferson, Franklin, or a real commander-in-chief, George Washington, at his farewell address, not these little boys that play commander-in-chief, that play golf, basketball, drive pickup trucks, and maybe play a game of cricket. You know, these aren't warriors. George Washington's farewell address, a man that led the troops, led the revolution, no foreign entanglements. So our basis of this movement is to bring home all the troops, self-defense. I'm a close combat practitioner, have been for over 25 years. I'm not a pacifist. I believe in protecting myself. I don't believe in attacking anybody who doesn't bother me. But if I go into somebody else's house and I start something, if they retaliate, you know, don't call me, you know, don't call them a terrorist. Call them getting even. So the founding fathers, trade with everyone that you'd like with, but don't get involved in their internal affairs. And this is a program to rebuild America, to use the tens of trillions, that's right, tens of trillions that have been spent since the end of the Cold War, and putting that money back to use into rebuilding America. How many more failures? How many more failures do people have to add up before they can call it what it is? And they can always make excuses as to why the failures happen. Here's one for you. The Korean War, a failure. Vietnam. Well, you know, if you let us bomb them more, hey, you weren't happy killing 3 million and poisoning the entire joint with Agent Orange? How about Iraq? Well, we never should have pulled out. You never should have went there in the beginning. It was based on false information. In the real world, they call them lies. Saddam Hussein did not have weapons of mass destruction and ties to Al-Qaeda. How about Afghanistan, the longest war in American history? You pick up this week's New York Times, listen to what's going on over there in the UK. The generals in charge are saying, well, maybe we didn't get it right. The English are saying, yeah, no kidding. You didn't get it right the other time either, and neither did Alexander the Great, and neither did the Russians. And you guys are in there for 13 years, and now the Taliban are taking over the provinces where the troops are withdrawing from. So that's what our program is. And we're not, this isn't a peace rally. This is a fight for peace. Because I would rather fight for peace than die for war. And it's not going to be one of those things where everybody chants, yay, yay, rah, rah, and then goes home. This is going to be takeaways. This is what we do to get we the people to decide the future of this country, not politicians that have sold us out for the military-industrial complex that General Dwight D. Eisenhower, five-star general, supreme commander of the Allied forces, no major wars were fought under his presidency. He warned us about. The military-industrial complex has taken over the nation, and now you could put onto that the cybersecurity-industrial complex.
War, and it is a self-preservation technique. It cannot be a stratagem used to line the pockets of corporate interests. It must only be used as a last measure to defend country and your borders. That being said, I mean, we all know we've got to defend our country.
And what I'm saying about bringing the troops home, self-defense, close the borders, lock them down. And all of this baloney, you know, they keep stealing our rights from us under the guise that they're going to protect us. And let's get this straight. They couldn't stop a guy from jumping over the White House fence, running inside. What, did he make himself a cup of tea, take a shower in there? I mean, stop with the baloney. You know, as Benjamin Franklin said, they that can give up essential liberty to obtain a little temporary safety deserve neither safety nor liberty.
And this is where I think you can really bring some perspective to the dialogue today. If we just kind of went back to World War I, World War II, we were no major military power. You might recall that it took incredible rallying power of our local industry, particularly our auto industry, aircraft industries, to get us into shape. I mean, we were just a out of shape militarily speaking. The world looked to the United States at the end of World War II as this nation that still had it right. And you could come to the United States and you find the American dream.
And this is why we're doing what we're doing. You talk about World War I, every historian knows, a totally, totally avoidable war. Right. And then it kept on going. You know, if there's six words that have destroyed America, I believe I can sum them up. Harvard, Princeton, Yale, bullets, bombs, and banks. A bunch of arrogant guys and girls who think they know better than us because they were born on third base, thought they hit a triple, and they're in the club. And I'll give you the example of it. But this man, in my belief, in looking at the founding fathers, and that's Woodrow Wilson, the president of Princeton before he became president of the United States. He's the man that the war was ready to end in Europe. They were bankrupt. They were busted. It was over. He was the one that got us into these foreign entanglements at the level he did. And he also sold out the nation with the Federal Reserve. He was the biggest traitor to America. Harvard, Princeton, Yale, go down the list. Obama, Bush, Clinton. It's the same destructive club that are destroying the greatness of this country. As you well pointed out, the land of opportunity. We did a lot of terrible things in this country, but who in their life doesn't? But we also did a lot of great things in this nation that made us the beacon of freedom. Look, Obama is bombing Syria. They're bombing Syria. Against the Constitution, the Phony Wars Powers Act doesn't even make a play in it. And, hey, who's going to win the World Series? Hey, you think the Kardashians could come back?
It is comical, isn't it? I mean,
it's disgusting.
You know, maybe we're getting the leaders that we deserve. I mean, it's been said that the people elect folks that reflect them the closest.
Well, here's my campaign slogan for the midterm elections. Republicans, Democrats, Bloods the Crips. Which gang of murderers and thieves are you going to vote for? And they're murderers and thieves. How many more millions do the Democrats and Republicans have to murder in the name of liberty and justice around the world? And how much more of our money do they have to steal from us in names of too big to fail, special tax breaks for their corporate friends, and inside deals?
It's a tired cliche, I think, to even bring up Orwell. He's almost a caricature now, I guess, for a cliche, but it's just so appropriate. 1984, it's almost like it is their guidebook for the powers that be, for our handlers, for our owners, to simply set the stage for complete lockdown control. War is peace. Peace is war. We've really covered this topic, and I'd like to get to another Trends Journal issue, and that's artificial intelligence. You're taking an interesting stance on this.
You know, as we look at it, it's artificial intelligence in one way, but the artificial intelligence is also becoming the way of the world. We're doing another story and a follow-up to that. We're calling it The Walking Dead. Look at every way you look. People are walking, they're either texting, they have earbuds in their ears, they're talking, they're drinking these big 32-ounce gulps of whatever they got in these plastic cups, toxic sludge, or they're eating. So as we're going into this so-called information age, it's becoming easier and easier to sell people through technology. They're controlled. You know, I was reading a story in the New York Times on a Sunday. It was Arianna Huffington and Kobe Bryant, one of these things, a basketball player. And I'm not into either of them, but I just wanted to read it to see where they were coming from. And the guy that's asking the question says words to the effect, well, all Americans are addicted to their cell phones. How about you? And I said, I don't have one. It's becoming the intelligence. That's what's becoming the realm of where we're going and where we've been, in the sense that there is no such thing as effective multitasking. I don't care what anybody says. I've read enough studies on it. And if you believe it does, there is such a thing. The next time you go to the dentist, if you have an important surgery to have, make sure your doctor or dentist is doing three or four or five other things as he's working on you or she's working on you, and then tell me how great multitasking.
Texting while driving, there's a big groundswell against it. Several web pages popping up warning. We hear horror story after horror story because on average it requires 5 seconds of looking away from your driving. And you know how much can happen in 5 seconds. Split second, exactly, because it takes so much time just for the mind to recognize that something has happened and for the foot to apply the brakes.
So when we're looking at this story, this artificial intelligence, it goes back to what you said about Orwell. It's almost become a cliche.
We're waiting for Skynet, right, from the Terminator movies. I mean, when decades ahead of their time with much of Arnold's movies there. So, I mean, I think you make a great point. But then there's, you know, the flip side. You show some fantastic opportunities that are coming up as a result of artificial intelligence. For instance, treating autistic children. You know, this is a traditionally intensive process. There are people who have withdrawn into their minds, most likely due to damage coming from toxins, sadly, within immunization as well as from other external stimuli, and some of it is genetic as well. But there are some fantastic treatments that you outline, and I'm sure we're going to see some more treatments for Alzheimer's folks, therapies that stem from artificial intelligence. It's just like everything else in technology, isn't it? Technology has that Janus-like two sides to it.
Oh, absolutely. You know, you really hit it on the nail on the head. Now, there are the positives as well, and many of them. I mean, look, our lives have changed so much because of the better elements of technology. The internet is the Alexandrian Library 2.0. You know, anybody that wants to seek out information is there for everyone. And with the artificial intelligence going into new levels of development and creativity, it could have wonderful, wonderful applications.
I think we've covered a few of the bases on a brief show today. What have I left out that you'd like to leave with the listening audience?
Global markets. And again, it's all tied together as well. You know, you're looking at destabilization in the Middle East to levels we haven't seen in years. And then, of course, the Ukraine crisis is still going on. And very important, oil prices. And there's another issue we cover, you know, quite in depth in the Trends Journal. I've been watching this start to unravel when oil hit, Brent crude hit $115 a barrel in June. This is a demand issue. Yes, there's a lot of supply. There's no question about it. But it's more of a demand issue. And demand is way down in China. Right now, there's certain kinds of iron products, rebar, for example, in China, a ton of rebar is cheaper than a ton of cabbage. That's how much excess commodity product is out there. So what this is signaling is a global slowdown. And I believe, in going back to gold, that you're going to see, and they're already talking about it, you're going to see new methods of stimulation to juice the sagging economies. And when that happens, that's when we're forecasting the next gold bull run. So here we are, we're looking at gold, you know, fluctuating a little over and above $1,200 an ounce. When gold breaks 1475, that's our magic number for the next gold bull run. The downside of gold, and again, we're not, as you well know, nobody, you look at the Trends Journal, advertising free. Nobody tells us what to do. We don't take money from advertisers for that issue of the Trends Journal. We're going to be issuing a Trends Journal monthly, which is different. But no gold advertisers, what I'm saying. And we don't get any money from any gold groups or anyone. So we're just saying this is our forecast. And that is the downside of gold is $100 to $150. We don't see it going below that. But the upside is much, much greater, and particularly with what's going on now. And as I said, we're launching Occupy Peace. Einstein's prophecy that I don't know how the Third World War will be fought, but the Fourth will be fought with sticks and stones, doesn't happen. Because as I was mentioning earlier, the First World War, as you had mentioned, this is really, and going over with Churchill and others, the First World War has set the whole stage for the destruction that's going on now in the Middle East when it was carved up by the colonial powers following the war. No more to war. To me, peace is patriotic.
And we're certainly on board with you with regard to the yellow metal. Very solid support around 1170. It's held up 4 years. And should it break? Yeah, well, you might see a retest of the $900 to $1,000 area. Technically speaking, once we get up there to your $1,400 zone, I think that's when the shorts start to cover and the momentum enters into the market. And then folks start to get all concerned about, have I missed the bottom and the next bull run? So it all sounds like great advice. Our listeners are going to appreciate that. Gerald Celente, Trends Journal Institute. We really appreciate you.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
Peter Grandich has published commentary on the mining and metals sector for 30 years. He's senior market commentator for Money Talks. Welcome, Peter Grandich.
Thank you, as always.
Great to have you back. And, you know, demand for gold continues to be robust. We just read article after article regarding the insatiable appetite by China and India's middle class for the yellow metal. Tell us why they just can't seem to get enough gold here.
We have not seen, even during the sharpest part of the decline, any significant drop-off in physical demand. In fact, as you pointed just out now, as prices have come down, we've actually seen physical demand increase, which one would think would lead to a significant rise back in the paper price. But I believe there's other forces at hand unrelated to the physical demand that has kept the paper market down.
Some of these forces, these invisible hands, as Adam Smith referred to them, have been of particular interest to precious metals investors in recent years. There's been a lot of speculation regarding manipulation. For instance, right now there's a case you may have read regarding silver price manipulation by three top investment banks. You know, we've heard about this for years, but obviously there are some very concerned investors who don't think that everything is going on above board in these markets, that there could be some rigging. Tell us more, please.
If I go and Google market rigging and markets where charges have been made of manipulation, I'll get a very long list of just about every market that exists. It stops at the door of the COMEX. Having said that, why we people then say, well, why is it that we don't see more about it is, it goes back to what I've tried to tell people for a good part of my 30 years on Wall Street and working around it, and that is gold and silver are disliked and not cared for by the vast, vast majority of people that work in the financial world. In fact, I'd say 98% of them really don't care. And we can know that if we went to the typical brokerage firm or local banker or insurance company and looked at their brokerage accounts, you would see almost no real any ownership of any type of gold, whether in physical form or through some paper derivative. And therefore, there's not a groundswell to call for these investigations and say, hey, wait a minute, if it's happening in all those markets, who's zooming who here? There must be something to this gold and silver manipulation. And it isn't coincidental. And, of course, we all hope we finally see the smoking gun before we die, but it really isn't coincidental that the bulk of this has happened in a most strange and peculiar way ever since certain countries showed up a few years ago and started to demand or at least see the gold that the United States was supposedly holding for them. And it's really ironic that there was never anybody saying to themselves of any importance, hey, wait a minute. A country asked for its gold. First, they couldn't see it. Then they got to see a little of it. Then they were told it would take up to 7 years to get back just 20% of it. There's something very, very wrong here. If that was the stock or bond market, there would be riots in the streets and markets would be down thousands of points. So, yes, it's difficult because we don't have a bunch of people claiming the same thing we are, but I don't think you have to be a rocket scientist to say that something smells very, very rotten, not in Denmark, but from the halls and vaults of the COMEX.
Exactly. No, it's not passing the smell test. And folks in this industry have said on this show for years that these paper promises, these stock notes, these common stock securities are actually owned by a clearinghouse that does not have the typical investor's best interests in mind. What you talk about, these 97, 98% of folks who primarily own paper promises or some derivative thereof, whether it be an ETF, an ETP, an option. There's so many different ways that folks can buy a share of a share of a share of something. What if there's no there? There. On the one hand, as an investor, I think it's great news to think that I'm one of the 2% who actually have faith in the precious metals. But the flip side of that is, what happens to us when the hungry hordes wake up, the dollar collapses, and there's virtually no wealth remaining? I mean, it's going to be quite a wealth transfer. So I think that leads to another interesting topic here I have for you, the potential for Amero. Sure, we've had some big strength. That's starting to wane in the greenback lately, but really looks like a last hurrah to me on the charts. It looks like just a final short squeeze to run out the weak hands. Could investors, could savings account holders, could checking account holders wake up one morning and have the same $10,000 or $20,000 in their savings and checking accounts, except instead of USD, could there be an AMO for something like a North American currency? Give us your speculation here, please.
I'm not really up on that to the point of being active and believing that it's, you know, a distinct possibility. I can address the dollar, and I will. I'll start by saying that it's not so much that the dollar is seeing strength, but the dollar is currently at the moment losing the race to the bottom to the base, meaning that it has been debasing its currency as many others have. But at the moment, Europe is certainly leading or trying to make to become the leader of that race in order to pick up its own economy. So what people have to understand is there hasn't been a decision among investors, hey, you know, the United States is just so much better off in so many particular reasons that I want to own its currency versus the yen or the euro. It's really just at the moment just not as fast in as much as this government has wanted it to be debased than the others. And that's why it's really been in a trading range. Now, it's true that it's on the upper end of its trading range now, but if you looked at a 10-year chart of the U.S. dollar, you will see that it's gone nowhere fast. But in the meantime, it has lost a significant part of its purchasing power. Will it ever be changed as a reserve currency? Absolutely. And the reason I feel I can say absolutely without just words is by actions we've seen over the last few years. Several key trading partners that once used the U.S. dollar as its reserve currency no longer does. And it continues to move away from that. Eventually, there will be enough interest in others to where the dollar will not be the reserve currency. What it's replaced with, I don't know. The likely argument, the front runner for me, would be the Chinese currency in some sort of way. And this may sound crazy, and I have nothing to support it other than just a good guess. But I believe China has been hoarding gold, and that one day we'll learn they have purchased even far more than the best speculators have put up. And one of the main reasons will be is that suddenly we will see that they have allowed their currency to become free trading, but the currency is going to be backed partially or in a very significant way by gold. And that will become the world standard. And I believe they would look to time that when it's truly the number one economy in all factors in the world, which is probably in the next 3 to 5 years. Now, that's just my speculation. There's nothing I can hang my head at other than, you know, some internet reports of some maybe some people speculating that. But that's the most likely place that will be the center of whatever the next world reserve currency is or how it's shaped. And I believe that world reserve currency will have some sort of gold backing it.
As you say, it's really a fata morgana. It's an illusion. It's a mirage, a relative increase in price. But like the great physicist said, everything is relative to your perspective. Sure, the greenback's going up relative to the euro with its negative interest rate. Now on to something else you talk about, and that's China accumulating gold. We've listened to Hugo Salinas Price. I'm sure you've read much of his comments and seen some of his commentary regarding a silver standard. And of course, yes, his native country, Mexico, is maybe the central point of silver in the world. So that would make some sense coming from that region. But he has a great idea. He says, look, central bankers, you can take just 10% of your gold reserve, buy silver. It would be a stockpile of silver. You know, we're somewhere near 70 to 1 on the gold to silver ratio. You're going to get a huge relative value. You could buy so much silver, the world's silver would disappear overnight, and distribute that to your people as a base, if you will, as a fail safe that people can just put away, and they won't spend it because it's too valuable. It's Gresham's Law. This will help stabilize economies like Greece and some of the peripheral nations. Tying this in with China. China's demand is simply astounding. You know, they just overtook India as the world's largest importer, but they're also the world's largest producer. And yet they don't send any, not one ounce, to the world. It is all held within that event horizon we call the border of China. Maybe they are preparing for a sea change event. And after all, Peter, they're holding the largest reserves of U.S. dollars. Tell us more.
Well, I think the other important factor to know, and it's not often discussed, but unlike here in the U.S., where savers have been driven to basically save for their retirement, not from defined pension plans where companies used to be responsible for it, but through the 401k market. And unlike here in China, those folks are strictly into physical metals, gold and silver. And so their wealth and their savings is tied to the metal, not a paper currency. And I just think that the Chinese authorities recognize and understand far better than Americans do the true historical value of gold and silver, and that's why they've done that. So, again, I just think that we have seen two different markets, the physical market, and this is it's hard for people to grasp this, but understand this. If the gold market was half as bad as the financial media and the vast people that literally hated in the U.S. in the financial service business, if it was as bad as every headline we read in the last 6 months, which is, I think, hundreds if not thousands against the gold and silver, then there should be just an outright, it's just like when the housing market went bad, it was just supply. There were no bids. When gas was crisis was held and car values dropped, they dropped. You couldn't sell any car that was a gas guzzler. Yet all this is supposedly all the fundamentals you read in the general financial journalism on the reasons you shouldn't own gold, yet why is there still such physical record demand? And so that's why it doesn't make sense, and that's why there's something very amiss between the physical market and the paper.
I think it's well said. And, you know, let's take a look at the numbers. Forget the commentary that comes from the officials. Let's look at what they're doing. Actions speak volumes. Look at China. Imported 2,000 tons. Imported from the West into China. Guess what the global supply was? Just 2,700 tons. In other words, China, 2013, consumed virtually the entire world's supply of gold. Footprints and the fingerprints all point to massive accumulation. They're preparing for something. Mike Maloney's done a great job, I think, pointing out to the precious metals crowd and to the world that the Shanghai Gold Exchange is a tiny little exchange, and yet it supplies nearly 10 times, it delivers nearly 10 times the gold of any exchange, whether you look at the COMEX or London. In other words, they're doing what an exchange is supposed to do, and that is disseminating precious metals to the folks who need and want. And their middle classes are accumulating wealth because they've read history, they're familiar with what's going on. But why Russia? Why is Russia accumulating such a large? I mean, right now they're at about 40 tons of metal, the largest purchase, Peter, in 15 years. What's going on there? What's Vladimir Putin thinking?
Well, I think he, too, believes that there's going to come a time when paper currencies, all of them, including the world reserve currency, is going to have some very serious problems. And so he's been a great believer in hard assets. He's always demonstrated that. And so I wouldn't be surprised at that. Again, I also think that when you get outside of North America and you have to travel it to actually appreciate it, people don't live in this don't-worry-be-happy atmosphere that currently reigns on Wall Street. And they see and believe that there are a whole host of fundamental problems, social, political, and economical, and they feel far safer with their values being in hard assets than they do in paper currencies. And you really can't appreciate that until you're actually out there. And the closest you can come to it, and this is what I always recommend to people in North America, Canadians aren't as bad as Americans, but they've gotten a little lax, too. And read not what's printed in the financial papers here, but read the Asian version of the Wall Street or the European versions of business journals. And there you'll see that people don't have the same attitude towards paper assets as they do here in North America.
You know, we've never promoted a portfolio of 100% of any one asset class. That's not what we're all about. We don't sell any precious metals. Almost every really top flight money manager, battle-hardened veteran of the markets knows from growing up listening to folks in my family and friends of the family, you always have a safety net. You have to have an escape route. You always have a parachute, okay? From everything I've ever read on the topic, you must have at least 15 to 20% precious metals because it's that insurance policy that you just hope to never have to cash in. And it tends to go up when everything else is struggling. I want to give you the last word on that topic.
Sure. Part of one of my businesses is insurance and asset protection. And I always tell people that, listen, we have our home insurance and we have our car insurance. Neither really want either one of them to burn up or disappear, but we want something to offset in case it happens. Even if you just approach gold and silver and not for profit, but hope it's an insurance policy that you never have to enact, and you know that your financial assets just go up, up and up. But you, like you're right, you need to have something in case the world is wrong, and in case the crowd is wrong. And like you said, it is nothing wrong having up to the levels that you spoke of for most people.
It's just common sense, and it, unfortunately, I think it's just not a topic palatable to most folks. I mean, we don't read about it. We don't hear about it in classrooms for the most part. You know, unless your specialty is this industry, you're just not going to hear about the insurance plan that you can have. If I take out a plan for my family, I'm going to have to pay monthly premiums. Okay, we all do. Car insurance, home insurance, health insurance, and life insurance. Nothing wrong with that, okay? But how about an insurance policy that either you pay nothing each month for, it gives you peace of mind at night. Gabelli now has a nearly 10% dividend, I think, somewhere around 9 to 10% closed fund. You get this wonderful dividend payout, a portfolio of the precious metals. Folks are just squeezing by on fixed incomes, an insurance plan that not only doesn't charge you each month, but might even throw off some interest. Peter Granditch, we love having you on the show.
It's always a pleasure.
This is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. When national health care, i.e. Obamacare, went into effect the first of this year, and there was lots of commotion and media play about the broken health care website, the delays in people signing up for coverage, and the general sense of disorganization that surrounded the subject in general, I had a lengthy discussion on the matter with my insurance agent regarding the differences for those people who signed up through a healthcare exchange versus buying a policy from their insurance agent. The one thing that stuck out from our conversation last year that I mentally filed away is what was going to happen during the open enrollment period starting October 1st, where the usage of the first year of national health care could actually begin to be tabulated. And then the fees that are paid for policies could be re-rated upward, no doubt. And then, and only then, would people begin to get a real glimpse into what a more centralized healthcare system would actually cost. Fast forward to October 1st, which has already passed. Conveniently, the start of the open enrollment period has been pushed back 45 days to November 15th, 11 days past the November 4th midterm elections. But they're telling us politics has nothing to do with that decision. Instead, we're led to believe it's to allow insurers to have more time to accurately budget for the new year, considering the sign-up delays and extensions in the spring, and of course, to provide us with the best possible information. That only leaves us with 45 days, over two holidays no less, Thanksgiving and Christmas, to budget what will no doubt be massive increases in our own healthcare costs. Costs many may not be able to afford. If these numbers were to come out October 1st, as they were supposed to, the November 4th elections may not be very hospitable for any politician, regardless of party, who supported or did not vigorously oppose national health care. But instead, a little sleight of hand has been employed on the legislative calendar, and the date change has gone by largely unchallenged, except for the typical political posturing. Now the monster is loose, and the reality that monster will impart in terms of cost increases come November 15th, will become a Grinch that will start early by stealing Thanksgiving and then Christmas for many, many people this year. As usage and costs increase dramatically on the healthcare front, so much potentially that the costs are deliberately being withheld in many states until after the elections, as in the 19% range in Iowa to the 37% range in Alaska, alarm bells should be ringing in your head. The fact is, a larger percentage of the population will not be able to afford higher health insurance rates. And that's the point of this whole exercise. This problem will create an anticipated reaction, which will set the stage for a new solution on health care to be settled in the 2016 presidential election. A single-payer national system, which is, was, and always has been the goal of where the architects of this policy always wanted to steer the outcome. The architects of national health care failed badly in 1994, when they tried to implement a single-payer system in one fell swoop. They regrouped and became much smarter and have unleashed a genie that unfortunately cannot be put back in the bottle. When the costs to the current system become backbreaking and unaffordable, the solution they have wanted to unveil all along will be ushered out as the salvation for all, a single-payer system. But unlike the single-payer system they attempted to sell us in 1994, this one will be wrapped up in all the latest technology, linked to your smartphone, tied to your tax return, cross-referenced to your driver's license, reflected on your FICO score, embedded in your credit card, and connected to your bank account. And you will cease being you. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. I have discussed from time to time that long before I was a corporate consultant or motivational speaker, I began my career in my early 20s as a professional magician. One of the fascinating things about studying magic is the psychology of magic, the root of deception, and the intricacies of sleight of hand. Understanding those principles is no guarantee you're not going to get fooled, manipulated, or deceived. But the possibility of deception goes down in proportion to your knowledge base on such matters. This week, I was explaining how a card trick worked to a longtime friend. I explained it involved a psychological strategy known as the canceling theory. Without getting technical, the canceling theory cancels or erases your mind's ability to backtrack, reconstruct, or figure out what just happened as the magician was shuffling the deck of cards, so that when you try and retrace the steps of what you just saw, you go back one or two steps and then hit a roadblock or a wall. Your ability to logically connect the dots breaks down, and whammo, what you just saw looks like real magic. The canceling theory is great when its application is limited to card tricks, coin tricks, or Las Vegas magic shows. But unfortunately, this kind of deceptive psychological strategy is used against the average person on a daily basis. It's hard enough to be an expert in your own business, never mind being an expert in everyone else's that you have to transact business in. But try you must, or you will fail. Some deceptions are so large and complicated, their size is their protection. And at the end of the day, if and when any irregularities are found, they are settled for pennies on the dollar. Case in point, this week, an algorithmic, high-frequency trading firm in New York called Athena was fined $1 million by the SEC for using complex computer programs to carry out a familiar manipulative scheme, marking the closing price of publicly traded companies. through a sophisticated algorithm. Athena manipulated the closing prices of thousands of NASDAQ-listed stocks over a six-month period. According to the SEC filing, between at least June through December of 2009, what they call the relevant period, Athena made large purchases or sales of the stocks in the last 2 seconds before NASDAQ's 4 p.m. close in order to drive the stock's closing prices slightly higher or lower. The manipulated closing prices allowed Athena to reap more reliable profits from its otherwise risky strategies. Internally, Athena called the algorithms that traded in the last few seconds gravy. Gravy, though, at whose expense? Elaborate algorithmic programs were created to establish their own version of the canceling theory. The filing stated, with high-powered computers, complex algorithms, and rapid-fire trades, Athena manipulated the closing prices of tens of thousands of stocks during the final seconds of almost every trading day during the relevant period. Although Athena was a relatively small firm, it dominated the market for these stocks in the last few seconds. Its trades made up over 70% of the total NASDAQ trading volume of the affected stocks in the seconds before the close of almost every trading day. Without admitting or denying the findings, Athena agreed to pay the $1 million penalty and cease and desist from committing or causing any future violations of the securities laws. If this small portion of the market is rigged, is it such a giant leap to understand that other larger parts of the market are rigged by larger, more sophisticated players for whom enforcement may never become an issue? Caveat emptor. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.